Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's yesteryear. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and there's true history coming up in this hour, and quite a bit of it, four programs profiling five different men who made their mark. Later, a salute to Dr. Walter Reed and Ulysses S. Grant, and two alchemists who made their name famous for a time. But right now, it's the Lives of Great Men series, brought to us by NBC on December 31st, 1938, profiling Spinoza, philosopher of the eternal.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The New Humanism and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Spinoza, philosopher of the eternal. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, among all men, Spinoza is the supreme example of complete dedication to the life of thought. Perception of pure truth with the reason was to him union with God and the highest blessedness. He was born in 1632 at Amsterdam of a Jewish family which had emigrated from Portugal to Holland to escape persecution. There was in him from the beginning that intense religiosity native to the Jews beyond all other peoples. The 17th century was a somewhat sterile epoch of culture. The Reformation had been fought through. Europe had settled down into opposing religious and political camps. That century saw, however, the development of foundations of modern philosophy, particularly in Descartes, who was Spinoza's master. One of the two books Spinoza published during his lifetime was a treatise on the philosophy of Descartes. Spinoza also owed much to Giordano Bruno and to continuing discoveries in astronomy and other fields of natural science. After early training by the rabbis in the Talmud and the great medieval Jewish masters, Spinoza turned to mathematics and natural philosophy. Latin was still the language of scholars, and this he studied with the revolutionary physician van den Ende. The story is probably authentic, that Spinoza loved van den Ende's daughter Clara and wished to marry her, but she wedded someone else. No other romance disturbed his life of thought, as all other personal relations were with scholars. Spinoza's early developed liberalism disturbed the Jewish congregation. Efforts were made to bring him to conform, including the offer of a considerable pension, which he declined. So at 24, he was officially excommunicated with that fearful curse used in the solemn ceremony. This expulsion by his people, with rejection by his family, accentuated the solitary character of his life. After an attempt to murder him, he moved to the home of a friend out from Amsterdam. There were several other neighborhood moves until finally he settled at The Hague. Spinoza's gentle, kindly spirit and consistent life of reason showed no resentment toward his persecutors. He lived completely a cardinal principle of his philosophy, that hatred can never be good, and he who wishes to avenge injuries by hating in return does indeed live miserably. But he who strives to drive out hatred by love fights joyfully and confidently. With the gentleness, he had fearless courage. While war was on between France and Holland, he was invited to meet an officer of the French army who offered him a pension if he would dedicate a book to Louis XIV. Spinoza refused, but on his return, he found the city in uproar against him. His landlord was terrified lest the house be stormed, but Spinoza assured him that at the first move by the mob, he would go out and face it, though that would have meant his death. When his friends, the DeWitt brothers, were murdered by a mob because of their Republican sympathies, Spinoza, also strongly Republican, was barely restrained from going out to protest and meet the same fate. His way of life was utterly simple. Abstemious in food, he would remain in his room for days at a time, having his modest meals sent in. Telescopic lenses had recently been invented, and Spinoza earned his meager living grinding and polishing them. This does not mean that he deprecated enjoyment. On the contrary, he tells us, nothing but a gloomy and sad superstition forbids enjoyment. No God and no human being, except an envious one, is delighted by my impotence or my trouble. or esteems as any virtue in us tears, sighs, fears, and other things of this kind. On the contrary, the greater the joy with which we are affected, the greater the perfection to which we pass thereby, the more do we necessarily partake of the divine nature. It is the part of a wise man to refresh and invigorate himself with moderate and pleasant eating and drinking, with sweet scents and the beauty of green plants, with ornament, with music, with sports, with the theater, and with all things of this kind which one man can enjoy without hurting another. Could there be a saner and healthier view of life? At 41, Spinoza was offered a chair in the University of Heidelberg, but declined to continue in full freedom the life of thought. A young medical student, De Vries, became much attached to Spinoza and offered him 2,000 florins, but Spinoza declined the gift. Then De Vries wished to will his large estate to Spinoza, but Spinoza persuaded him to bequeath it to De Vries' brother. This was done on condition that the brother give Spinoza a living pension. After De Vries' death, the brother sought to arrange this as a 500 florins annuity, but Spinoza refused to accept more than 300. There is an opinion prevalent among Gentiles that the Jews love money. In Spinoza's case, it is impressively answered. He was bitterly attacked for the other book issued during his lifetime, the Theological Political Tract. In it, he urged complete freedom of thought and speech. The book was prohibited by the States General, but continued to be published anonymously under changed titles. His greatest works never saw the light, except through correspondence with scholars, until after his death, which came at the age of 45. Perhaps the dust from the lens grinding may have caused the 20 years tubercular infection which brought so early an end to his life. Among the posthumous publications is the little tract on the emendation of the intellect, written early and giving the program of Spinoza's intellectual life. He tells us that when he had discovered how futile are the ends men usually seek, he set out to find some good that is eternal. This could be found only in love of some object, infinite and eternal, that feeds the mind with joy alone. The path to that end must be the improvement of the mind, till it is able to achieve the pure perception of truth. So he classifies the four types of knowledge, passing from hearsay through opinion and argument to the fourth kind of knowledge, which is immediate perception of the essential nature of anything known. This program Spinoza worked out through years of reflection in his masterpiece, The Ethic. He attempts the geometrical method in dealing with spiritual problems. His work is thus the highest example of pure rationalism in all philosophy. His aim is to see all things under the aspect of eternity, since only so can their essential truth be recognized. Eternity, he holds, cannot be explained by duration. It is not time stretched out, but another mode of being. He holds that God is all, expressed in two parallel attributes, thought and extension, thus annulling the conventional dualism of mind and matter. Perception of truth becomes a partaking of God's being, and he argues, he who has a true idea knows at the same time that he has a true idea, nor can he doubt the truth of the thing. Just as light reveals both itself and the darkness, so truth is the standard of itself and of the false. That last sentence is to me the finest statement of the intellectual life ever written. Truth is like sunlight that carries its own warrant and illuminates itself. You do not have to prove that the sun is shining. Open your eyes and see. Thus, when the mind sees under the aspect of eternity, it knows that it sees. This explains why the great poets often help us more than the abstract and arguing philosophers. The artist sees and gives us his vision. As far as it goes, it is truth. Spinoza's cardinal ethical principle is self-affirmation, the effort to realize oneself. He says, the foundation of virtue is the endeavor itself to preserve our own being. And happiness consists in this, that a man can preserve his own being. It follows that virtue is to be desired for its own sake, nor is there anything more excellent or more useful to us than virtue, for the sake of which virtue ought to be desired. It follows that all persons who kill themselves are impotent in mind and have been thoroughly overcome by external causes opposed to their nature. The last statement may well be pondered in a time when so many have abandoned life because of the loss of material possessions, showing a lack of that inner resource it was Spinoza's aim to achieve. His analysis of the passions and of the bondage to which they must subject us is one of the most thorough and effective ever made. There are remarkable anticipations of Freud and other current psychologists in this portion of the ethic. Spinoza's reflections on life are often more illuminating than his logical arguments. The book is full of epigrams, pungently phrasing whole, balanced truths. Here is one which each of us should take home to himself. The greatest pride, or the greatest despondency, is the greatest ignorance of oneself. How sound that is, since self-depreciation is nothing but self-conceit turned wrong side out. The closing book deals with the power of the intellect to achieve freedom of mind or blessedness. This is to come through the intellectual love of God. The whole book is a sort of high geometrical argument for the beatific vision of Dante, and Spinoza has rightly been called the God-intoxicated man. He concludes, "Hence we clearly understand that our salvation or blessedness or liberty consists in a constant and eternal love towards God, or in the love of God towards men. This love or blessedness is called glory in the sacred writings, and not without reason, for whether it be related to God or to the mind, it may properly be called repose of mind, which is in truth not distinguished from glory." Of the high effect of Spinoza on other minds, a notable example is given by one strikingly contrasting with him, the worldling Goethe. After some romantic episodes of his youth, when he was expiating poetically, Goethe says, "The mind which worked upon me thus decisively, and which is destined to affect so deeply my whole mode of thinking, was Spinoza. After looking through the world in vain to find a means of development for my strange nature, I at last fell upon the ethics of this philosopher. Of what I read out of the work and of what I read into it, I can give no account. Enough that I found in it a sedative for my passions, and that a free, wide view over the sensible and moral world seemed to open before me. But what especially riveted me to him was the utter disinterestedness which shone forth in his every sentence. That wonderful sentiment, 'He who truly loves God must not desire God to love him in return,' together with all the preliminary propositions on which it rests and all the consequences that follow from it, filled my whole mind to be disinterested in everything, but the most of all in love and friendship. That was my highest desire, my maxim, my practice. So as that subsequent hasty saying of mine, 'If I love thee, what is that to thee?' was spoken right out of my heart. Moreover, it must not be forgotten here that the closest unions are those of opposites. The all-composing calmness of Spinoza was in striking contrast with my all-disturbing activity. His mathematical method was the direct opposite of my poetic humor and my way of writing. And that very precision, which was thought ill-adapted to moral subjects, made me his enthusiastic disciple, his most decided worshiper. Mind and heart, understanding and sense, sought each other with an eager affinity, binding together the most different natures." Goethe rightly states the value of Spinoza. By giving the view of life under the aspect of eternity, he lifts to serenity and peace. The last proposition of the ethic is, "Blessedness is not the reward of virtue, but is virtue itself. Nor do we delight in blessedness because we restrain our lusts, but on the contrary, because we delight in it, therefore we restrain them." In developing this proposition, the last word of the ethic, which we will well take to heart, is, "All noble things are as difficult as they are rare." Let me, my friends, wish you a truly happy new year. May it be one of recovery, not only from material depression, but from the war terrors that have so sadly afflicted mankind.
Spinoza, philosopher of the eternal, has been the subject of another program in a series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Voltaire, intellectual leader of the 18th century.
The Lives of Great Men, on Tuned to Yesterday, that NBC broadcast from December 31st, 1938. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now on to the 89th program, released by the Treasury Department, called Treasury Salute, where we'll hear a profile, along with music, of Dr. Walter Reed. It's next from June 12th, 1944.
The Treasury Salute. a program of the United States Treasury featuring Robert Merrill, Bill Adams, and the Treasury Orchestra under the direction of David Brookman. Buy bonds and more bonds. Let's all back the attack. Buy more than before.
How do you do? This is Bill Adams. For countless thousands of years, man has fought wars. His commanders have won earth-shaking victories. But against one enemy, even the most brilliant general has had to surrender his sword. That enemy was disease. It was in the Spanish-American War that the generals turned to the disease-fighting doctors and said, "You are a part of the high command." It was thus that Major Walter Reed came into history and stayed an immortal. Today we salute this engineer of health, a man who has made life more secure for millions, who has made the winning of this war a thing of less chance and greater surety.
When you hear them bells go ding-ling-ling, all joy round and sweetly you must sing, and when the verse and through, in the chorus all join in, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. Bells go ding-ling-ling, all join round, and sweetly you must sing, and when the verse and through, in the chorus all join in, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight.
Figures don't lie, and the figures of the deaths among American soldiers during and after the Spanish-American War showed that more men died of yellow fever than of bullets. And when Major Walter Reed arrived at Camarones, Cuba, in June of 1900, soldiers were still dying, and not a soul in the world knew how they contracted the fever. Of course, every doctor had had his own opinion. It was contagious through clothes worn by stricken men, or it could be killed with sulfur smoke, or it was a hot vapor in the air. But no one really knew, and in all honesty, Dr. Reed didn't have the vaguest idea. There was, however, a funny, crotchety old doctor in Havana who kept crying over and over that yellow fever was called by a mosquito. But nobody listened to old Dr. Finley, except Walter Reed, who was a very big man, big enough to know how much he didn't know. So after 18 months of trying to find the germ in the stricken blood of dying men, Walter Reed and his fellow doctors, James Carroll and Jesse Lazier, decided to investigate this mosquito theory. You probably think that was an easy choice, but consider this. No animal ever contracts yellow fever. No guinea pigs or monkeys or swine. Only human beings. That meant that if they were to solve this plague of yellow fever, they'd have to use live, healthy, mature human beings. There's no doubt that Walter Reed fought with this problem many hours, pacing the still quiet of the summer Cuban nights in the agony of indecision, not hearing the music played in the plague-filled air. Music like Pan Americana.
Thank you.
For the moment, suppose yourself to be Walter Reed. You stand in the tent-topped hospital in Cuba, see the line of beds. You stand aside as the 20th man that day is carried out feet first. You add up the total number and shake your head. You let your thoughts encircle the globe. Millions die each year. Millions of good people with children and homes. You project your thoughts into the future. Your job is to help make a safer world. And no matter how much you hate hurting people, and you do, that's your job. So you go into your office where two men are waiting, a soldier and a civilian clerk. These men are volunteers. You say, "Gentlemen, do you realize the danger? I intend to let an infected mosquito bite you." Private Kissinger and Citizen John Moran of Ohio agree only on condition that they do so without compensation. "Gentlemen," you answer, "I salute you." 2 weeks later, Kissinger is bitten by the lethal bug, packed full of a fresh meal of dying soldiers' blood. In 7 days, he is racked with fever. But he lives, proving the theory of mosquitoes. He lives to hear music again.
"Goodbye, Dolly, I must leave you, though it breaks my heart to go. Something tells me I am needed at the front to fight the foe. See the soldier boys are marching, and I can no longer stay. I hear the bugle calling, goodbye, Dolly Gray."
Scientists don't prove a thing by one experiment. One mosquito didn't solve the yellow fever problem. Walter Reed, having set out upon a course, pursued it with more volunteers, some of them Cubans. He had to prove that clothes weren't carriers of contagion. So he had three men live for 21 days in a hot room filled with blankets, clothes, bed sheets, in which men had died in agony, things spotted with blood and filth. In the next room, he put Mr. Moran, a room clean to the last inch, cool and comfortable, with only one fault. It contained several infected mosquitoes. Moran got the fever. The other men didn't, which proved that a pest hole without mosquitoes was safer than a clean house with them. Well, in the end, Walter Reed found out what caused yellow fever. With determination, it could be wiped off the face of the earth. So when he died in 1902, he died knowing he'd done a great thing. In this war of movement and width, the moment our forces have gained an objective, they open up a second front on mosquitoes. Every soldier is a mosquito hunter. It is a total war on yellow fever. Thanks to Walter Reed, the enemy cannot enjoy the satisfaction of a buzzing fifth column where American troops are fighting.
"Let's bring you glory, oh glory, the flag of show the world a big parade. Come, men that have the stuff that heroes are made of. Let's bring you glory, oh glory. With friends and courage we'll win through. So wave on, oh glory, and with the help of God we'll bring your glory to you."
Thanks to the courage and determination of Walter Reed and his associates, one mortal enemy of mankind has been conquered. Thanks to the heroic bravery of our fighting boys today, the enemies of the world will be conquered. But those boys of ours must have our help here at home. And our help means our money. So get behind the Fifth War Loan Drive with every dollar you can dig up. When a war bond worker comes to your home, sign up for twice the bonds you bought in the last drive. Back the attack. Buy double the war bonds you bought before and do it now. The United States Treasury thanks Robert Merrill and Bill Adams, who appeared on this especially transcribed program. The Treasury salute was written by Forrest Barnes and directed by Paul Lewis. The music was conducted by David Brookman. This is Vincent Connolly speaking.
Treasury Salute, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 12, 1944, a syndicated recording. We continue now with this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with a broadcast of This Is the Story. The episode titled Ulysses S. Grant was released for syndication in 1951.
This is the story. The incredible story of an invincible American soldier who met an unbeatable enemy in disguise. And you'll hear another story. The amusing story of a boy who proved he'd be a great musician by hammering a piano to pieces. Yes, this is the story.
As he moved silently from room to room that evening, closing the offices of the bank for the last time, the young clerk wore a sober and troubled expression. But it was not the problems of his famous and powerful employers that concerned him. After all, he had his own worries. From the moment that he'd seen the headlines in the morning papers screaming that the bank had failed, that one of its partners had been indicted as a thief and a swindler, from that moment, the clerk had known that he was out of a job, that he would have to start tramping the streets again in search of another one. And so now, as he took a last look around, all he felt was self-pity and a kind of slow, burning resentment. Who in the world, he wondered, had such rotten luck as he? And what had he done to deserve it? It was then that he opened the door to the innermost office. He paused on the threshold and uttered a low, astonished whistle. Why, he'd thought the bank was long since deserted. But there, sitting at his desk in silent despair, his head dropped forward on his chest, his hands clutching the arms of his chair, was one of the clerk's erstwhile employers. In that instant, all thought of himself vanished from the clerk's mind. He was consumed with pity of a different sort, with indignation that was deeper and stronger than resentment. He cleared his throat.
I beg your pardon, sir, but it's rather late, sir, and I'm closing up. Can I see you home, sir?
Apparently the man at the desk didn't hear. He seemed lost in another, a remote and distant world. The world of the past, the clerk thought. Perhaps he was living over again the glory and the honor he had known, fighting once more the brilliant battles of a bygone day, feeling the thrill of power, the flesh of victory. It was incredible that he should have come to this, that he should be sitting here a broken and despondent man, he of all men on earth. Hesitantly, the clerk stepped forward. Gingerly, he touched the slouching, almost lifeless figure on the shoulder. The old man glanced up. Old man? He could scarcely be more than 60, the clerk remembered, but he looked old, ages older. He smiled nervously, blinked his eyes, ran a trembling hand through his beard, and then he murmured,
Oh, yes. Yes, time to be going, eh? It's all over, isn't it? I suppose you read it in the papers, how he's been swindling me right along. And to think I had faith in him, my partner. Well, I know better now.
I shall never trust another human being again.
The clerk stood frozen to the spot, watching the great man pull himself from his chair. To hear such words from those lips, that he would never trust another human being. He who had heard the cheers of a mighty nation ringing in his ears, who had received from a grateful people the highest tribute that was in their power to bestow. The old man spoke again, awkwardly, almost with embarrassment.
I don't imagine you've been giving your salary for this week, have you? I'd be glad to give it to you myself, but, I'm temporarily out of funds. Perhaps after my partner comes to trial.
The clerk fought back the tears that rose in his eyes. Temporarily out of funds. He knew what that meant. Destitute, poverty-stricken, hopelessly in debt, this man. It didn't matter, the clerk said quickly. He could get along without his week's salary. He was happy to have worked here for such an employer. It had been an honor to be associated with such an illustrious figure. If there was anything he could do to show his gratitude. But the great man stopped him with a wave of the hand, as if he feared some expression of pity. He'd fallen low, he seemed to answer, but not low enough to be pitied. And then, straightening his shoulders, he shook the clerk's hand, and with the proud and martial bearing of an old soldier, no, of a general, a leader of soldiers, he left the bank. And thus, with that same bearing, that same stubborn pride, he walked along the streets of New York City towards his home. Not once did he seem to notice the glances that were cast in his direction, glances of mingled admiration and sympathy. Did they remember, these curious passers-by, that less than 20 years ago he had stood at the head of a triumphant army? Did they recall that just 5 years later he had accepted a position of power that made him the equal of kings, the peer of potentates? And did they suspect that now he was penniless, ready to throw himself on public charity? Not until he had entered the private confines of his home did the old soldier allow his shoulders to slump beneath the burden of grief and failure. Now that he was alone again, he could but wait. He was not quite alone. There was someone waiting for him here, a stranger who had read the news and come rushing to visit him, a man whose face he had never seen before. Out of the shadows, the stranger stepped. Firmly, but with tact and grace, he informed the broken old man.
I have come here to assist you, sir. I have unlimited means at my disposal, and I am placing them at yours. You cannot refuse, because what I am offering you is neither a loan nor a gift. It is payment for services rendered to the country that I love. Services ending April 1865.
What his name was, this generous, patriotic stranger, will perhaps never be known. What is known, however, is that without his assistance, the old general might have lived out the remainder of his days in disgraceful want and misery. Disgraceful not to the general himself, for he was above disgrace, but to his fellow countrymen. For this broken man, swindled of his fortune and all but bereft of friends at the age of 60... had, at the age of 43, accepted the unconditional surrender of the armies of the Confederacy at Appomattox Courthouse, and 3 years later, at 46, had been elected President of the United States. Today, his name ranks high among the noblest heroes of American history, the name of Ulysses S. Grant. This is the story. All the way from Busetto to Larancole, the piano tuner brooded on his wrongs and on the reward he would exact for them. The rain sliced against his face. The wind whipped past him, seizing the very breath from his mouth and carrying it away. Double his fee? Why, he ought to treble it. That's what he ought to do. And if he weren't such a kind-hearted man, that's what he would do. And then he reached the inn at Larancole, and he heard from the innkeeper exactly why he had been brought out on such a day.
Ah, you're just in time, Signor Cavaletti. If you come any later, my son, he wouldn't have been able to practice his lesson. You see, it's the boy's spinet that's broken, and he's wanting to play it.
Oh, so he was waiting to play it, was he? That infant that Stefan Cavaletti found in the music room, that ugly, undersized little 10-year-old, it was for him that the piano tuner had braved the storm. Controlling himself, Signor Cavaletti bent to his work. But in an instant, he had straightened up again, his face red with rage, his eyes blazing. Angrily, he thundered.
How can anyone repair a spinet in such a condition as this, huh? Why, it has been ruined. It looks as if it had been smashed with a hammer.
It was then that the 10-year-old child spoke up in a tone that was simple and clear and wholly unafraid. He announced that it had been smashed with a hammer. Yes, it had. And that he himself, who had smashed it just a few hours before.
Oh, you did you? And for that, I had to ride 3 miles in the rain. Well, your father, he will pay for it, my young friend. Now he will pay me 4 times my regular fee. Do you hear me? Huh? 4 times. Because you don't like to practice your lessons.
Oh, but he did like to, the child assured the piano tuner. Signor Cavalletti misunderstood. He had smashed it only because he was angry at himself. Angry at the clumsiness of his playing. Angry because his tiny fingers would not stretch far enough to play the beautiful chords he so longed to play. Somewhat mollified, Signor Cavalletti began to work at the spinet. And as he worked, the child standing beside him continued to talk. He spoke of how he loved music, of how he hoped someday to be a great musician, perhaps even a great composer. Now and then, the piano tuner's eyes would rest on him, and there was no anger in them now. There was only a gentle admiration, something almost akin to a fatherly pride. At last, the spinet was repaired, and the child sat down to play for the piano tuner. And for a long time, the piano tuner listened and was strangely silent. And when he left the innkeeper saw him to the door. How much did he owe him, he asked. What was his charge for being brought out on this rainy day? To which, with a blush and lowered eyes, Stefan Cavalletti replied,
Nothing, senor. You owe me nothing at all. It was an honor to be permitted to repair that spinet for your son.
Today, in a museum in the little village of Larancole, in Italy, that same spinet still stands. On a piece of paper pasted inside it may be read this message. I, Stefan Cavalletti, piano tuner, have repaired this spinet free of charge. The talent of the innkeeper's son and his love for the instrument were more than a sufficient reward for my labor. Thus it was the piano tuner of Busseto, who was the first to recognize the genius of the child who was someday to compose such beloved operas as Aida, Otello, and Il Trovatore, the child who bore the immortal name of Giuseppe Verdi. Yes, this is the story.
This is the story on Tuned to Yesterday, that syndicated broadcast from 1951. And we wrap up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with an episode of The Passing Parade. Hosted by John Nesbitt and released for syndication in the later 1940s, we hear the tale of two alchemists next.
This is John Nesbitt with a new chapter in the review of human adventure we call The Passing Parade. And our subject today involves two of the romantic and half-mad men who once spent their lives in the attempt to turn cheap metals into gold. Because they both discovered treasure worth more than gold, but failed to realize what they had found, they have a story for us to tell. After a moment, then, we turn to the portraits of two celebrated alchemists of Time's Passing Parade. On our reviewing stand again, one of the fanciest pipe dreams that humans have ever indulged in is the old idea of finding the secret of changing a couple of dollars worth of lead or mercury into a couple of $1,000 worth of pure yellow gold. Consider, for example, the tricky gentleman who nearly upset the finances of Europe with his claims to have found out how to make gold. This man was half fraud, half genius. For one day in 1695, a short, dark-faced Italian, calling himself Count Domenico Caetano, showed up in Holland with the announcement that the secret of the ages was a secret no longer, that he of all men had found out how to turn mercury into gold. The King of Holland gave him $24,000 with which to equip a laboratory and carry on his experiments. And into the laboratory the Count disappeared. Far into the night his lamp burned as he labored over his benches. Yet at the end of 6 months' time, no gold had ever come out of that laboratory. The monarch's soldiers rushed in just as Caetano was trying to climb out a back window, and they threw him into the dungeon cell. And there for 6 years, the Count and his wonderful secret moldered away. Then, a certain day in 17-2, the guard found the bars sawed through and the cell empty. A few months later, a Count Ruggiero showed up in Vienna, collected a tidy fortune from the Emperor Leopold, vanished once more, again without making an ounce of real gold. Now come to March 5th, 1705. Again, as Count Caetano, and this time with a beautiful wife, he appears in Berlin, Germany. He takes a fine house, he drives around in a coach and four, he wears fine clothing, and calmly announces that the source of his wealth is a secret of his, the secret of how to make gold out of mercury. Naturally, he is summoned at once to the palace of King Frederick I, and quite as naturally, he demands $50,000 to equip a laboratory. The skeptical king demands that before he receive a single dollar, he show what he can do. To everyone's amazement, Caetano agrees. At the appointed time, the king, the crown prince, several courtiers, and some goldsmiths to test the gold, and Alfred Deppel, the most famous alchemist of the day, all arrive at Caetano's evil-smelling laboratory. It is a dark, strange place, filled with shelves of chemicals, glass retorts, and a sayer's furnace in one corner. Count Caetano, dressed in a long, flowing, silken robe trimmed with expensive fur, sweeps into the room, bows before the king, and begins his demonstration. Putting a quantity of mercury into a clay crucible, he adds a few drops of a mysterious red tincture. Yellow fumes hiss and boil out of the crucible. Caetano takes it up with tongs, sets it in the furnace, and pumps the bellows. Now the furnace glows and fills the dark room with a vivid orange light. The crucible turns white hot. The chemist now draws it out and stirs it thoroughly with a metal rod, plunges it into cold water to cool it, and then smashes it to bits with a hammer. The king, the alchemist, and the goldsmiths rush forward. And sure enough, without any doubt, there are the fragments of undeniably pure yellow gold mixed in with the contents of the broken crucible. The king is overjoyed. He gives Caetano all the money that he needs. He commissions him a major general of the artillery. He showers him with gifts of rare wines, diamond-studded portraits, serves him magnificent banquets, and builds him the finest laboratory in Germany, and then tells him to get busy and start making the gold. Once again, Caetano disappears into the laboratory. Once again, no gold. Once again, the soldiers catch him in the act of escaping. His laboratory was searched, and the secret was out. He had used a hollow stirring rod, which had a lead plug in one end. This rod had undoubtedly been filled with bits of gold, and when Caetano had stirred the hot mercury, the lead plug had melted out, letting the gold fall into the crucible, an old piece of stage magic. And they hanged the count to a gilded scaffold, and they wrote on his tombstone, "Here lies the greatest rascal that ever lived." And of course, Caetano was indeed a skunk with a beard and a very swift character when it came to skinning a sucker. So what could this faker have really found that would be of value and give shape to our lives today? We'll go into the reason for telling you this story as we turn in a moment to a second story of the alchemists of time's passing parade. This is John Nesbitt returning to our review of a pair of famous alchemists. And here is a scene which continues our look into the mysterious lives of two of the many thousands of men who attempted to learn how to run up a batch of pure gold practically on a kitchen stove. The second alchemist was a different sort than the trickster we called the Count Caetano. This man was one of those who profoundly believed that the secret formula for gold existed and could be discovered. We must travel back more than 4.5 centuries now to where, in the Italian town of Padua, in a dark attic room, a white-bearded 84-year-old man named Bernard Trevisan is lying on a bed very ill. On a charcoal stove, there is a huge clay bowl. It is filled with a bad-smelling concoction that is slowly boiling and filling the dark room with choking fumes. The old man's eyes look despairingly toward the great boiling crucible, and his lips move in a prayer. "God grant me one more day of life to finish my experiment." Bernard Trevisan had begun 70 years before this to search for the secret that man had sought for 20 centuries. That is, the secret formula for the Philosopher's Stone, which was supposed to turn lead into gold. He began as a boy of 14. He was a rich man's son. He inherited immense estates and a huge fortune, every penny of which he poured into his experiments. He had traveled to Egypt, Cyprus, Rome, Greece, Palestine, and Turkey. He searched 6 years alone for the emerald tablet on which Sarah, the wife of Abraham, had engraved the secret formula for making gold. He searched 14 years for a cave near Hebron in Palestine, where Alexander the Great had said that the secret was written on the walls. He read for 10 years the ancient books of mysteries that were to be found in the Egyptian ruins. And then, his estates gone, his fortune spent, with scarcely enough money to keep him in food, he believed that he had found it at last, the secret formula which was certain to be right. But Bernard Trevisan found it too late. With the great crucible still boiling, the experiment still untested, a visitor came into that smoking laboratory and finished it for him. The visitor was Death. And just in case you would like to know what that secret formula was, for which countless men have paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to know, and for which Bernard Trevisan devoted his entire life, here it is, exactly as it appears in the ancient, crumbling, paged books of the alchemists. With it, say the old directions, you can turn lead into gold and make yourself a millionaire. Have you a pencil ready? First, you take 2,000 hard-boiled eggs. Remove the shells and heat in a flame until the eggs are thoroughly charred. Mix the whites and yolks thoroughly. Add the charred shells, which have been well powdered, and pour in the following additional ingredients: olive oil, borax, litharge, sulfuric acid, and the milk of 2 white Arabian horses. Now place your mixture in a large crucible, and stirring constantly, heat it over a slow fire for 8 years, and there you have it. The only thing to watch, says the ancient recipe, is not to make too much gold at once, or of course you'll debase its value and make it as worthless as sand. Of course it didn't work. Not a grain of gold ever came out of it, but it took you 8 years to find out that it wasn't any good, and by that time the man who had sold you the recipe was far, far away. And yet the greatest scientists of the Middle Ages firmly believed that gold could be made out of lead, and right up into our own time the search continues. By means of modern atom-smashing machines, gold actually has been made out of mercury, but the cost is still so great and the amounts made so small that ordinary gold from the earth is still far the cheaper of the two. But the importance of the story lies here. Our whole modern civilization is built upon the science of metallurgy and the science of chemistry. And the alchemists, in their search for 25-carat gold, were founding the priceless modern sciences of chemistry without realizing it. They kept turning up all sorts of interesting and now supremely valuable alloys of metals, but they chucked the formulas away because those metals were not gold. And those lost discoveries of the alchemists waited for centuries before other modern men rediscovered them and became millionaires. After a moment, we'll come back with today's footnote to the passing parade. For our footnote this time, it may be of interest to remark that not only charlatans, but the greatest of our scientists have in the past engaged in the search for a secret of turning base metal into gold. Among them was the great Sir Isaac Newton and Robert Boyle, the father of modern chemistry. At one time, the English government had coins which were minted of a supposed gold made by alchemists, and some of these coins are collector's items today worth far more than pure gold. But the Scotch people, being canny, had these coins analyzed, found they were fakes, and an act of Parliament was passed against them. Our time's up. Until we meet again, this is John Nesbitt bidding a very goodbye to you all.
The Passing Parade on Tuned to Yesterday. John Nesbitt, the host, in that syndicated broadcast from the later 1940s. And that brings to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I do hope you enjoyed all of the programs you've heard. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. It's been a pleasure.